How do you see us keeping society together in the midst of having to bring in more foreigners?
Let me have a drink first. Because this is going to be a long answer. Well, first, let me put it in context. Our TFR has been unfortunately declining over the years, as you have seen. 2024, our TFR was 0.97. That was the first year that it did not decline, the same as 2023, I think. But the unfortunate thing is 2024 was a dragon year. So in dragon year, usually you have a uplift, a blip. And in 2024, which was a dragon year, we did not have a blip. And many people think that, oh, at least our TFR has stabilized. So I keep telling people that, no, not quite. Because that blip did not disappear. The blip was there, except the base has come down further. So the blip has allowed it to stay at 0.97, thereabout. Which means, I think it will continue to come down. And 2025 numbers, we are still working on it, and we will share more details in time to come. But I must say, I'm not likely to give good news on the TFR front. But by nature, I'm an optimist. So despite the fact that we are facing great challenges in TFR, I don't think we should give up on it. We should do what we can to support parenthood, to support families, to see how we can have more babies in time to come. So we'll do what we can. But the reality is that I'm optimist, I'm also a realist. The reality is that I think even at 0.97 or even at 1, we are actually below 50% of replacement rate. And that is not good news anyway. So whatever TFR that we have, I think we are going to have a very low birth rate, and the number of babies that we produce will not be enough to replace ourselves, which means that if we do nothing, the Singapore citizen core will begin to shrink after a while. Now we still are benefiting from longevity. Many of our old seniors are living longer, and therefore the population is still quite healthy. But if we don't do anything, over time, the Singapore citizen population will decline. And as a declining citizen population, I think we will lose dynamics, we will lose a lot of opportunities to be able to do a lot of things. So I think it is important for us to continue to maintain our citizenship, citizen population core, and hopefully allow it to grow. And we may not be able to grow very quickly, but at least have a moderate growth rate over a period of time. Even our, despite our immigration policies and so on, our citizenship growth rate over time has also come down. If you look back over the last 10 years, the first 5 years, our citizenship population grew at 0.87% per annum. Not 1%, not 8.7%, 0.87% per annum, 0.86% per annum. Then the last 5 years, it grew at 0.76% per annum. And last year, up to June 2025, 1 year, the growth rate was 0.7% per annum. So even despite the immigration policies and so on, our citizenship population growth rate is still growing, but the growth rate is slowing down. We have to be mindful how we can make sure that we will continue to have a strong citizenship core, continue to have a dynamic population, dynamic society, and that is very important for us. But coming back to the core of the question, having immigration and having foreigners working among us, how do we ensure that we are able to integrate them? How can we ensure that we are able to work together with them side by side for the benefit of Singapore and Singaporeans? And that is the key question. So therefore, it's important for us to continue to focus on measures that encourages and supports social integration, especially for the new citizens. Because foreign workers, there are many types of different types of foreign workers, construction, marine, process workers, domestic workers, as well as those that are working in the retail sectors and manufacturing sectors, are very different. And they have different challenges, and we need to look at them quite differently in managing this foreign worker population. But those who are PRs, and eventually those who become citizens, we'll need to think about how we can integrate them better. We have citizenship, Singapore Citizen Journey Program to help new citizens to better understand our culture, our values, our practices. And we also have a PR Journey Program, which we piloted in 2024. I think we will continue to refine these programs. But it is also important for us as a starting point to acknowledge and to know that they are different from us, because they are new citizens. They have spent a good part of their life in different culture, have different practices, maybe hold different values. But the fact that they have decided to become Singapore citizens, they have decided that there's something common between Singapore and them, that they want to become part of this bigger fraternity, if you like. And therefore, they have decided to cast their lot with us, and they want to embrace Singapore. But at the same time, we need to recognize that some of the differences will remain. So the challenge is for us to see how we can recognize the differences while at the same time expand the commonality, the common space between the new citizens and Singaporeans, existing Singaporeans, so that we can become a more dynamic society. I think this is going to be the key challenge. The Chinese has a term called 存异求同. That means recognizing and to some extent preserving some of the differences, but at the same time expand the commonality so that there's more space for us to work together, to live together, to learn together, and to grow old together. So I think there are already many similarities, including some of them may have family ties with us. They came from similar background culture from our neighbors, for example. A lot easier to assimilate. There may be some that are more challenging to assimilate, so there are different challenges. But what is also important is that we need to look at it from multiple angles. First, as they come in, we need to assimilate them to Singapore's values and systems. We need to familiarize them with the way we work in Singapore, our culture, our values, our practices. At the same time, we also need to encourage Singaporeans to accept them, to embrace them, recognizing that there are differences, but at the same time, create more spaces for them to interact with one another. So in the community, you'll find that there are a lot of programs, natural programs, activities, and so on that they participate in, both local Singaporeans as well as new citizens, including PRs. They all participate in these activities together, and they get to know one another. And there are also PRs who are volunteering in the community work that will give them the opportunity to integrate into the community, and for the community, for the residents to get to know them better. But this is an uphill task. I don't think we should trivialize it, and it's ongoing, always work in progress, because with every generation of a new generation of new immigrants, the challenges are different, and we need to continue to change our program, but we must continue to seek to integrate them better into the society. And if you are able to do that, if we can integrate them better, then we can build trust between the new citizens and the existing citizens, Singaporeans. And if we're able to build trust, we have a better, bigger capacity to be able to absorb them, to be able to integrate them. And this way, the whole of Singapore will be better off. I think that's the way forward for us.
Thank you. I will turn to the floor. First question from here? Okay. Yes.
Hi, I'm Angie from Brown Center, a mental health charity. So what I wanted to ask and also to put forth is there is a big concern with immigration because there's so much fear that the immigrants are going to do better. And I think this is not just Singapore, it's all the countries that have immigration. And if we don't overcome this, we're not going to get the talents, we're not going to get the population replacement or expansion. And I am concerned that that's tied to also our Singaporeans being experiencing burnout. And 40 years ago, I was a naturalized Singaporean from Malaysia. We never even used the word burnout. I mean, like, we come here and we work. And there's always a more hardworking attitude with immigrants. Maybe because we don't have parents to worry about going home to have dinners with them, so we work 12 hours. And then we don't have weekends that we need to spend time with friends or relatives. And then we really focus into work. So that's also part of...
This was 40 years ago?
Yeah, 40 years ago.
But now you don't feel the same, having assimilated?
No, I'm still working hard. Okay. So while we have this work-life balance conversation, I am very concerned with the young people. If they do not understand the economic growth and sustainability is key to Singapore's success, how are we going to rely on our young people to move Singapore forward? Work has to come as a priority when we're starting a career. Otherwise, you know, do you have another solution for us? Because companies are going to move the jobs overseas because people there are working harder. It's great that, you know, DPM is from MTI.
Yeah.
These people are working harder and at lower cost. So we need to wake up to the fact that how do we help to build a more resilient group of youths? And unfortunately for our affluence, many youths feel that I don't really need to work. So they talk about meaning in life. Sorry.
Okay, I think we've got the point. We've got the point.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. Just to add to that, when we talk about foreign workers and we talk about kindness, which was covered by the last panel, if our kindness doesn't extend to migrant workers, domestic workers, let's not kid ourselves, we're just camouflaging kindness. So let's start with real kindness in acknowledging every contributor to Singapore nation building. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I'm feeling burnt out already. Thank you. You know, in about 20 years ago, this is from a wise man who taught me this frame of thought. He said 20 years ago, there are countries who are low cost, very competitive, but the products are not so good. And there are countries with very good products, but they are very expensive, not low cost. And Singapore, fortunately, during those times, 20 years ago, we are good quality, not so expensive, and therefore we are very competitive. But over time, the low cost countries' quality are getting better. And good quality countries, their costs are getting cheaper, more competitive because automation, AI, and so on. They're moving faster in cost effectiveness. And therefore, the low cost is getting better and the high quality is getting cheaper. And Singapore has to move. If we don't move, we will have no place at the table. I think it's important for us to make sure that we are moving faster, keep getting better all the time so that we remain competitive. But I take your point that it is important for us to also ensure there's some balance. As in our pursuit for excellence, we need to know that competition generally, actually, the real competition doesn't come from within, comes from outside. We are competing with many, many countries in the world. Many of our industries, export-oriented industries, are competing with the rest of the world, and many of them are lower cost getting better and higher quality getting cheaper. So we have to make sure that we remain competitive in many of these important sectors. Semiconductor, pharmaceuticals are just some of the examples. Aviation, aerospace, and so on. All these are very highly competitive global sectors. And we just have to make sure that we keep pace with competition. We want to stay one step ahead of our competitors. And sometimes I always say that you may not be able to keep one step ahead, but at least half a step ahead. I think if you are able to keep half a step ahead, I think we will be able to continue to create opportunities for Singapore and Singaporeans. And I do accept that sometimes Singaporeans feel they are facing a lot of competition at their workplaces, from their fellow Singaporeans, from foreigners who work side by side, and also even from new citizens who are no longer foreigners, but still continue to work with him side by side, and they are creating competition among them. So I think this sense of competition is real. We have to recognize them. But it is also something that we have to accept, that we just have to continue to compete with the rest of the world, because this is Singapore. We are open. We don't have critical minerals. We don't have oil, we don't have gas, we just have our people. So we have to make sure that our people will be most competitive in the world. And how do we do that? We want to do that through giving them the best education and training system in the world. And that's why we introduced SkillsFuture, and we upgraded SkillsFuture to SkillsFuture Level Up to give them another chance, another bite of the cherry in the education to get a diploma in their mid-career so that they can reset their skill set to continue to be competitive. And we provide support services and so on, particularly for those who have been displaced. We want to help them find jobs, find work, so that they can continue to be gainfully employed. So I think these are the things that we work together, and we have a very strong tripartite relationship that we work together, government with the employers, with the unions, to see how we can continue to make sure that our workforce remains competitive. What is also important is to ensure that despite the competition, the workplace continue to be fair, continue to be equitable to the workers, to the employers, so that we've introduced a Fair Working Practice Act, so that we ensure that the workplace will continue to provide a fair and equitable terms for our employees. But what is critical for us is to continue to provide opportunities, one, for the workers to upgrade themselves, two, for the companies to transform so that you're always a competitive enterprise, and third, continue to bring in new businesses, create new opportunities for both enterprise and workers. This way, we will be able to continue to keep Singapore competitive for many more years to come. But at the same time, I recognize that we will need to also manage the stress at the workplace, help Singaporeans to be able to cope with the stress. I must say that the stress is not just at the workplace. I think in community, there's also a lot of stress. And nowadays, I get a lot of feedback about noise generated from neighbors because they want to rest. They find it very stressful to have so much noise and from all kinds of things. In Punggol, particularly, you know, where I came from, we have aircraft noise from the airbase. We keep explaining to my neighbors that this is national defense. We need to train our pilots, and some of them ask, can they don't fly at night? Because at night I need to rest. I have to explain, well, our enemies don't stop at night, and therefore they have to train at night, and sometimes they go out for exercise, by the time they come back, their land is quite late into the night. But they happen rarely, so I explain to them, they'll try their best to manage the timing, but a level of training is necessary. So it's also stressful in the community. In schools, they're also very stressful, I'm sure. Many of my residents also complain and say, you know, my grandchildren, most of them are grandchildren, when I talk to the older folks. My grandchildren face a lot of stress, a lot of exam stress and so on. I think stress is par for life. The key is how can we help Singaporeans, children, adults, workers, even seniors, how to help them to have a greater capacity to cope with stress. Some of the techniques is something that we will need to continue to help and teach them and share with them. And I think you do a very important job in focusing on mental wellness and stress management. This is an important topic that we can continue to discuss.
Can I have a question from somebody from the schools, the strawberry generation?
What?
Are you from the school?
Yeah, from Nanyang Poly.
Okay, go ahead.
So, hi, my name is Darren. Yeah, from Nanyang Poly, Banking and Finance. So, this is my question to the DPM. Initially, I want to ask in session two, but I think this question fits you since you are in the political leadership. So, this is my question. So, government speeches often invoke a we society. So, we referring primarily to Singaporeans. This, however, can unintentionally exclude foreigners when leaders call on Singaporeans to be involved in integration efforts. So in response, some have suggested that political leaders and society should actively involve foreigners themselves into the integration process, including through explicit running calls for foreigners to engage with Singaporeans in the integration process. In okay. such a context, however, so some Singaporeans might perceive leaders as being in favor of having foreigners over citizens when they call on foreigners to integrate Singapore. So this is my question. So what can leaders do to promote genuine integration between groups while avoiding a situation where Singaporeans feel that leaders are increasingly accommodating foreigners at the expense of Singaporeans? And I think that fits to you okay. of how you would communicate with the Singaporeans as well as the upcoming leadership.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We first, but who's we?
Yeah. So I was about to ask first, don't you want to object to a strawberry generation label put on you? I'm surprised you didn't object.
So no, it doesn't bother me.
Self-confidence. Yeah, I'm who I am. Doesn't matter what you call me. Very good. This is our hope for the future. But what is important is, I think Janada's put it correctly. We first, but who are we? And I just want to, this is what Prime Minister said, so this is my own interpretation. I think we first doesn't mean that we first, you later, or we first, they later. Actually, we first means we before I. So the key is, who are we? All of us together is we. The difference is not about me and myself alone, but about us together collectively. So we can be this group of people, we can be my company's interest must come first before my own interest. We can be Punggol come first before Gan Kim Yong. So there are different ways of looking at it, but the key message really is, rather than focusing on ourselves, focus on the collective good. And the we could include foreigners. The we, I think just now there was a good comment about, we must take care of foreigners when they are here, they contribute to our economy. They are migrant workers, domestic helpers, workers that help us in domestic work. We must take care of them. We have a responsibility to take care of them first. And therefore, it's important for us to make sure that we take care of all of us together as a collective society. And so we first could mean my residents, could mean my society, our circle of friends, our circle of contact. We must look at collective benefit rather than individual personal benefit. I think that's the idea of a we first society. Not so much we and them and we and you. So I think it's not a divisive approach, but more a collective, inclusive approach to look at we first rather than I first.
That's a very good answer. One more, yeah.
I'm Corinna Lim from
Uwara. Hi.
Mr. Gan, thank you for your comments, very helpful. When people say we first, and when I think about Singapore, I think the trust is very much with government. It is a vertical trust. And in some ways, it detracts from the horizontal trust. Because, government will fix it. There's a problem, there's an opportunity, government will fix it. And there's not that much space, in fact, or in motivation for community to come together to try to be the solution. So I wonder what you think about that, because the problem is that you want to have a we first nation, but you're not the right person to say it, because in saying it, then are we going to be detracting from the horizontal ties that we want to bind, that we want to build? So that's one. The second point is on competition. It's come up in an earlier panel, and it's about the competitive values that we have. One, do we even have time to think about anything beyond myself and my family? And two, when we look at the values of our society, caregiving, paid caregiving, teachers, social workers, child caregivers, they are among the lowest paid. We used to say, is it a question of gender, or is it that we value care so little? And if that is the case, then how do we build a we first society, which must put care of the next person first. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
First of all, the premise of the question.
Yeah. First part of the question, I beg to differ, because I think the horizontal trust is as important as a vertical trust, as you put it. So I think the trust between people and government is very important, so that the government's policies and so on can be implemented with the residents, with the people's support and trust in that you are doing good for the country, for the people. So I think that trust is important. But trust among the people is equally important, and we sometimes tend to ignore it, tend to understate it, but it is very critical. I give you one example.
Yeah.
COVID-19 was the best test of a horizontal trust. And this horizontal trust has broken down in so many countries. And in Singapore, we are very fortunate that we were able to withhold that trust, to hold that trust together. One example is mask wearing. The whole idea of a mask wearing is not quite to protect yourself, but to protect others. If you remember, we tried to explain, because the mask is to prevent your sneeze and your cough from transmitting the virus to the next person. So to wear masks is to protect others. If you have no mutual trust, why should I bother to wear masks? It's about me and myself. I don't worry about you. But if everybody does that, everybody will get infected, because nobody will be wearing masks. But in Singapore, we are quite conscientious in wearing masks for all of us, and we know that wearing it is to protect others. So I think this is a very good illustration of how horizontal trust among the people operates in a crisis situation. And therefore, I must disagree with you that we focus only on vertical. It's equally important to have horizontal trust.
I totally agree. And that's what I'm saying. It is very important. But yes, sometimes, because in the COVID situation, I would argue that the trust was with Gov. When you said wear masks, we all complied. It's true, because you were so convincing, as you are now. So actually,
Corinna,
I disagree with you.
I disagree with you. We didn't see, we saw horizontal trust on a large scale during COVID.
Yes.
The problem is whether or not you can maintain that momentum or that value in peacetime.
Yeah. Yeah. But I can sort of accept that in peacetime, when there are no crisis, no emergency, I think there's a little bit more about I want to achieve, I want to progress, because there's no pressing need for me to give way to others. Yeah. So I think there's a bit of that reality setting in. But whenever crisis happens, whenever emergency happens, I think we all will rise up to the occasion and be counted as one of the member of the society. So I think, but that is very important, so that in emergency, we know we can count on Singaporeans. So I think this is to answer your first question. Sorry, what's the second question?
Is something that was raised in earlier session too, whether there's a contradiction between competition and social capital.
Yeah.
And social cohesion.
Yeah. So I think, please take a seat. I think that competition, as I try to explain, it's a reality, and the world is very competitive. And I think those who are in business will feel it very keenly. I think this year and for the years to come, the world has become even more troubling. I think the fragmentation is happening at unseen speed, and polarization between different trading blocks is happening, and the trade agreements are breaking down. And I think the core principles of a most favored nation principle, MFN principle, is also being undermined. I think many of you who are in the business will appreciate that. And therefore, competition will become even more keen going forward. I think this is something that is a reality we have to face up with. Singapore being an open economy, we have to compete, we have to remain competitive. But it's also important for us to remember that career, money, and opportunity is not everything. It's also important to spend time with family. It's always important for us to make a balance in our work-life balance. This is a very interesting term, work-life balance. So it's important for us to manage that, so that there is a purpose even in our competition. If you just compete for the purpose of competing, at the end, you are not sure what you are competing for. So I think our family ties, our fraternity, our relationship is the anchor for us to allow us to compete in our day jobs. Say, for example, despite all our programs, I have dinner with my mother-in-law every Sunday night. And if I can't, I'm overseas, I try to dial back. Now today we have technology, you can Zoom. Last time cannot. So now you can Zoom quite easily, call back, say hello to mom, and then they have their dinner. So we make it a practice every Sunday night. No matter how busy we are, unless we are overseas, we come and meet, have dinner with my mother-in-law. I think this is something that you need to decide and make up your mind that I'm going to commit to this. I'm going to pay attention to my family. I'm going to invest in relationship as much as I invest in my career and my future and in my wages and my income. I want to give my family a good quality of life, but at the same time, I want to maintain my family relationship. I think relationship is something you have to spend time and spend effort and spend resources in managing and growing. You cannot take it for granted that it will flourish on its own. It doesn't. So I think it's a balance that you need to strike.
Paul?
Thank you. Paul Tambaya. The question is in my own capacity and not with any institution. So today we've heard a little bit about wealth inequality. So I'd like to ask about health inequality. And I think some of the best data we have on this is from an answer, DPM Gunn, that you gave in February 2021 to a parliamentary question, where you pointed out that when you adjust for age, gender, and ethnicity, that those from the lower socioeconomic class, that's those with below secondary education, are 70% more likely to have diabetes, 20% more likely to have hypertension, and 20% more likely to have high cholesterol. So these are quite serious numbers, which are quite troubling. They're similar to some other countries like the UK and US. Yeah. But Singapore is a relatively smaller place. So many of us are hoping that something can be done to address this, to level up the lower SES group when it comes to health status. Unfortunately, the recent changes in healthcare financing policy appear to be moving in the opposite direction, where instead of going after the big corporations which run the big private medical centers or the insurance companies, what's happened is the plan is to raise the deductible for those who have riders, which, again, there is some basis for this. There's some theoretical idea that people will charge more if they know that the patient has a rider. But the unintended consequence is likely to drive people to the public sector, which is already doing a great job under tremendous stress. So my question is, instead of that, whether we could try and find some way to level up, the idea of MediShield Life for all, perhaps lowering the deductible in MediShield Life, making sure that, you know, there is an umbrella for low-income Singaporeans so that you can try and narrow this gap in the chronic illnesses that you mentioned earlier. Thanks.
Yeah. Not sure how the second first half relates to second.
Yeah, I was about to say there are two different questions. Yeah. First is on diabetes.
Why do we take the first half first?
Okay. So the first half, the answer is that is why we have a war on diabetes, which we started. This is the first war that Singapore has declared in Parliament. And this is a good
one. So high blood pressure and high cholesterol.
Yeah, so I think subsequent to that, I think Minister Ong Ye Kung started war on salt. So I think we have multiple wars, and we hope we are, but it's going to be a long war. As I think as a medical professional, you know, the results are not going to happen overnight. It's a generational shift. And many of these diabetes occurrence incidents is actually a result of lifestyle, a result of the way you active lifestyle and the diet pattern, and many factors are involved. And the whole idea of a war on diabetes is to do so with regardless of race, language, religion, and income. We want to wage war against diabetes for everyone. And the reason that we highlighted the prevalence level of different ethnic groups, different income levels, is to help us to focus on target of our war effort to see which are the areas that's most need this impact of this war on diabetes. So that is the reason why we analyze the data to help us focus our efforts so that we hopefully over time the incidence rate of diabetes will come down over the long term. But it's quite different from the healthcare part of it, because by the time you have diabetes and need healthcare, it's already happened. So I think quite different. On the second question, I hope I answered your first question on tackling the health status of the Singaporeans regardless of income. And that is also why we started Healthier SG, to make sure that we start this healthy lifestyle early so that they do not end up having a problem, chronic disease problem later on in their life, a later stage of their life. So I think that's the purpose of a healthier SG strategy and the war on diabetes. But on healthcare facilities and affordability, I think precisely because we have MediShield Life and we have a very high quality public healthcare system that we operate, and therefore it provides a safety net to make sure that no one will be denied appropriate care. If you go to the public healthcare system, I wouldn't say that it's a bad thing for them to go to the public healthcare system. We do want Singaporeans to be able to have access to the public healthcare system. It's of good quality and we take care of them. And MediShield Life is designed to be adequate for the public healthcare system. There will be some that have a very low income that cannot afford the co-payment, the deductibles, and there will be MediFund. To be able to help them with additional subsidies. So I think in terms of healthcare, especially for the lower income, it's not an issue. If you have any problem, talk to the healthcare, medical, social workers, and they'll find ways to help you and to support you. But for the riders, precisely because these are the insurance itself is not cheap. So we want to make sure that people will get value for the money that they put into riders. And therefore, we need to tweak the rider design to make sure that they continue to deliver value for patients. And we are in the process of reviewing, and we are continuing to review that. I think Health Minister will make the necessary announcement at the appropriate point in time. But it is important for us to remember that for the lower income particularly, public healthcare system is probably the best solution for you. And if need be, there'll be additional subsidies to make sure that you'll always be able to afford healthcare in the public healthcare system.
I'll take one question from there behind. Go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon, Minister Gan and Mr. Janardas. My name is Stefan and I'm from the NUS Students Union. So today we talked a lot about building communities, protecting minorities, and of course fostering that kindness within our society. And we also examined kind of the role of digital tools in, you know, how it affects our relationship building within our society. I also just wanted to consider the role of national narratives in building this culture and national sentiment. I think historically, when we think about the Singapore story, it's always been one of survival, you know, of competition and a struggle for existence. And I wonder how, you know, these national narratives might continue to evolve to kind of balance the community focus. What are your thoughts as DPM?
Thank you very much. The sad part of the story is that this survival existential challenge remains there. I think the world has become a lot more fragmented, and Singapore has always thrived on the international cooperation and collaboration. So I think we have the world's largest number of free trade agreements with different countries. The last count is 28 FTAs that we have, and that provides us a market, open up access to our businesses to be able to export to them. And this is becoming a very important for us for economic progress. But over the last couple of years, in fact, it started even before President Trump came into office, the world is beginning to change. In between countries, the room for cooperation has shrunk over time, and the competition has set in. And when economies compete with one another, the space for cooperation will shrink. So I think over time, Singapore's global economic space will also shrink. And therefore, we need to continue to stay competitive, continue to find opportunities for Singapore companies to grow and to expand. And that's why we set up the economic strategy review last few months, and soon they will share more details of their outcome of their review. And that will help us chart the new blueprint going forward to allow us to continue to grow our economy in this very challenging and volatile operating environment. So I think that's important. But you also mentioned about the narrative for the community, and that is also increasingly important, because our society has also become a lot more complex, a lot more fault lines, if you were, and in between different groups, whether it's in between ethnic groups, between locals and foreign, between the lower income and the higher income, there will always be this tension. And how do we ensure that we are able to move forward as one society? That's going to be one of the key challenges for us, for the new generation of leaders. And that is why PM Wong has mentioned the We First Society as one of the key narratives to lead us forward. And that is focused on community development and community integration among our various sectors in the community.
I see somebody there. Okay.
Hi, I'm Edwin Lau, representing the representing the Victoria Junior College. So, it was mentioned earlier that there's an increasing emphasis on working harder to keep up with the international competition, but people are also attributing our low TFR and decreasing TFR because of this rat race. So what things can we actually do to move forward with both of our goals? Thank you.
That's a very good question.
It's a very good question, but the answer is very difficult. Because we have... Sorry?
Meditate.
I think competition will continue, and the sad news is the falling TFR is not just Singapore alone. I think globally, almost every country, with the exception of a few, have been seeing falling TFR. So I think this is a global phenomenon. I think Singapore is particularly acute, because in many other countries, even though there's a falling TFR, but they have huge tracts of rural areas which TFR is relatively quite high. Although nationwide is still falling, but there's still hope in more suburban areas. But Singapore is just one city. And if you compare with all the cities in the world, almost all the modern cities in the world have very low TFR. And the other cities in other countries have the benefit of urbanization from residents from outside the city moving into the city, but we have no outside the city. Our outside is still the part of the city. And further outside is the sea. So that I think, therefore, we have a limited capacity. And that therein lies the problem. So one suggestion is don't spend too much time attending IPS seminar. Work hard on having more babies.
You mean socialize,
yeah. Yeah, but I mean, well, they are in Hua Chong, is it, or where are you from?
Victoria.
Victoria, yeah, Victoria. Focus on study first. I must give a proper advice for the rest of the adults.
I think earlier session, he got up and said that he learned more from here than he would have learned at school.
Not the procreation part. So I do hope that we do need to have a balance in life. And I know this sounds like a broken record, but I do want to emphasize that don't take relationship for granted. It takes time and it takes a lot of investment to manage the relationship, to grow the relationship. You cannot expect to have high TFR without spending effort in investing in the relationship. So within the community in Punggol, for example, we are working very hard to create opportunities for people to mingle, to meet each other, to have activities together. We are going to have the Outward Bound School, this advertisement. the new Outward Bound School in the Punggol in Coney Island. Yeah. It's a fantastic place, not designed specifically for TFR. I must clarify.
That will be the headline tomorrow.
No, not designed for TFR. But what I'm saying is that I think we need to invest in community development, invest in our family, invest in relationship, so that I think we will have a hope of arresting the decline in the TFR. So I think it requires all hands on deck.